This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Today we begin an ongoing discussion about systemic racism in our region and what's being done about it. We start with the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, which have spread across the country and around the globe. Many protesters have marched to demand justice for George Floyd and for the many other black men and women who have died unjustly at the hands of police officers. Joining us now is someone who's been at the forefront of many protests around New York State. Siobhana Renee Newsom is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Greater New York. She was also a Democratic candidate for the U.S. House in the 15th Congressional District in the Bronx. Ms. Newsom, thanks for taking time today to talk with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Could you tell us something about the Black Lives Matter movement of Greater New York? How did you get that started?
The way we started it was during the primaries, the last general election. We ran a successful campaign called I Ain't Voting Until Black Lives Matter, meaning we understood as a people that no legislation was coming our way. The Democrats would make us promises, the Republicans would make us promises. So until one of those parties came to us with a sound agenda for the liberation of black people, we were withholding our vote. So we had protested at the Republican National Convention, the DNC convention, and my brother, Hawk Newsom, we came back home, we were sitting at my mother's kitchen table, and we're like, hey, you know there's a Black Lives Matter Greater New York here, and they're trying to fight systemic oppression through the arts, but we believe that we needed a more direct way, a more radical way to get the legislative changes that our community desired and needed. So there came the birth of Black Lives Matter Greater New York.
And when you talk about needed legislation, is your focus strictly on the national level, or do you look to Albany, too, to make changes?
Albany happens a lot, actually. As we know, New York State set the tone for the world. The world's always looking to see how New York will vote, how progressive it will be. So most of our effective policy changes that we've had and legislation that we've influenced has been in New York State.
We've all seen the energy that the Black Lives Matter movement has brought to the drive for racial justice since the killing of George Floyd. How do you keep this issue top of mind for those not directly involved in the demonstrations? What action is Black Lives Matter taking now?
Well, I feel the uprising since George Floyd. I was in Minneapolis when the first officer was arrested. I was on the ground there. And it started with police brutality. It started with arresting those four officers. But I think that this movement has expanded into a call for equity across the board. It's a call to fight all of those injustices as we see coming out of this defunding the police. We see housing coming out of this. We see ending qualified immunity, reparations. So it started as, okay, arrest these officers. But I think the movement grew into more, and it's calling for the full liberation of black lives in this country and for black lives to truly matter.
Are you confident that the momentum can continue?
As an organizer, someone who's been on the ground when there was very little public interest, we see that the tides come. People are energized for about a week or so, but it's going on 8 weeks now, and the country and the world is not letting up. I received calls from Black Lives Matter, Tel Aviv, Australia, Denmark, Chiang Mai. People are still in the uproar, and unfortunately, George Floyd's death galvanized the people. So I don't see it ending anytime soon. I think it will not always be taking to the streets with full force, but I see policy changing coming out of it. I see a lot of community and cooperative things where there's mutual aid, where people are coming together in solidarity to achieve a common goal.
Are you surprised at all by who has joined the protests, both in terms of numbers and I guess I would call it the demographics, a mix of races marching in the streets together?
Actually, I'm not surprised, and I would hope that I would see this during my time. As we saw with the original civil rights movement, there were queer folks on the front lines, there were white freedom fighters. So I think when injustice happens and the world truly sees things as a human rights issue, because I think with the death of George Floyd, he was humanized. Usually people are dehumanized when it comes to black people in America. So I'm not surprised by the turnout. And then you have a whole population of people who were supporting Bernie Sanders who wanted a new democracy. And because people had time, usually things happen and everyone's bogged down by their own personal issues and things they have to achieve and accomplish, that being home during this pandemic allowed the world to really internalize, to process, and then take to action over the death of George Floyd.
Is this particular mix of circumstances right now, and I suppose we could include COVID-19 and what it's done to employment, the economy, and other aspects of life today, is this particular mix of circumstances unique, different enough to make this a turning point, perhaps more intense than we've seen from civil rights movements of the past?
I think that's proven to be so. This is actually the largest civil rights movement that the world has ever seen. And the proof is in the numbers and the demographic. And we have to think about other civil rights movement and the way information was disseminated. Now anyone can get involved. We have sites like Justice for George NYC that tells you several protests in all five boroughs of New York City that are happening. And the way that communities are able to connect, how when I went to Minneapolis for George Floyd, Black Lives Matter in Minnesota reached out via Facebook. And they asked for a virtual rally, and they said they needed help. So I think the accessibility and how easily people are able to connect and the current circumstances will allow us to get the justice that we deserve.
There was some violence in some of the early protests. What do you say to those who may want to use the demonstrations to agitate for a different agenda than Black Lives Matter?
I understand that. And I feel as the people who were coming out, I don't condemn or condone the looting and the vandalism, because most of these things were done to property. And it makes me think of Dr. Martin Luther King and when he said that riots are the cries of the unheard. So I don't express my frustration like that. We as a group, we do not, but we understood the frustration level. And unfortunately, it was needed for this country to take notice. When there's public unrest, you see how quickly laws begin to change. When we talk about those like the repealing 50A and police officer misconduct and chokehold bills, and now we have something coming up in New York. I believe State Senator Biagi just put up a piece of legislation regarding qualified immunity. That unrest in the street, and when Americans take to the street, as we always have with the Boston Tea Party and any kind of revolution or liberation we wanted, things happen rather quickly.
Would you say that people are safe during the protests?
For the most part, it's now as a protester, the dynamic has changed for me. There was always worrying about the law enforcement, as I have been tear gassed. I have come upon firing squads, officers in formation, rather. Right now, with the current climate here in America, we also have to be fearful of white supremacists. They are showing up. They are counter-protesters. So the dynamic is changing. Most of the ones I've attended, people have come home safely. We've seen the videos of police cruisers going into crowds of people. We have seen people brutalized by police department, asthma attacks brought on by chemical agents being sprayed. So if anything, people should be fearful of law enforcement during these times, and also be on lookout for anyone who may be a white supremacist, which is very hard to tell given the demographics of the current marches that are happening.
What do you want people to take away from either participating in or watching the demonstrations?
The same sentiment applies to everything that I do or involve myself in. I want people sitting at home who may not be able to come out onto the front lines, I want people to know that they are powerful, that say our chapter started with two people who wanted justice, who said no more, and we had bullhorns and T-shirts. So when you watch your fellow Americans, your fellow citizens, the people, your neighbors, your friends out there protesting, I hope it inspires something inside of you. It makes you want to do more. And that may mean feeding the hungry in your community, lobbying your local politicians for things you want, running for office. I just want everyone to feel empowered by what they see.
Siobhana Renee Newsom is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Greater New York. Ms. Newsom, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day, and God bless everyone.
Thank you. People of faith have a long history of leading the call for racial justice. In Connecticut, faith leaders have been organizing marches that demand police accountability and transparency in response to the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. The Reverend Dr. Anthony Bennett is the lead pastor of the Mount Airy Baptist Church in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and co-chair of Connect. Connect's a collective of churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, and civic organizations from New Haven and Fairfield counties. And Pastor Bennett joins me now on the phone. Hello. Thanks for taking time today.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here again.
Could you tell us a bit more about Connect, the organization, and the work that you do with it?
Well, Connect is a collective, multi-faith, multicultural collaborative of institutions organizing around power and building relational power.
And how long have you and the organization worked toward racial justice?
Well, Connect is a part of a larger national organizing network that doesn't specifically deal with race as it is coming now, but deals with the underlying causes of housing inequities, educational inequities, criminal justice reform. So our approach is directly around those structural issues.
How have you been organizing people to get involved, to respond to the death of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and everyone who's died in similar violent circumstances?
Well, I think it's multifaceted. I have been doing it through our congregation, through our church and collective of churches, as well as through Connect. Because of coronavirus, Zoom conversations around race and inequities, because it's not just police brutality, but it is anti-black white supremacy and its ideology that permeates every aspect of the American culture. And so we have been having those kinds of discussions, meeting with individuals impacted, and really recently talking and supporting the next generation of activists and organizers who are pushing these issues to the forefront, some of whom are part of the larger national conversation and organizing efforts to bring attention to what many in the African-American community have known for decades and years.
As the protesters were marching in the streets, who did you see getting involved in this movement, a re-energized movement for racial justice? What kind of a mix of people did you see?
Well, in Bridgeport, I think you see a mixture of races and a mixture of cultures. And yes, and I think throughout Connecticut, I see that kind of pattern. Certainly in the more urban areas of New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, there is a predominance of persons of color, black and brown people, but there were whites in the mix. And then in other suburban towns in Connecticut, I've seen predominantly whites stand up and speak up against this.
Is this mix different from other previous demonstrations, protests, looking back in history?
The focus is not so much just on the mix, but the purpose of realizing that the narrative that many have been told about America and about its relationship with law enforcement and other agencies have been a lie. And I think more persons from a variety of backgrounds are waking up to that reality.
What do you think sparked that this time, at this point in history? Perhaps it didn't happen before. Is this a turning point of some sort, do you think?
Some may say. I'm not sure. And I think we can be cautiously optimistic. I think there is just the predisposition of America not to see itself and to want to feed its narrative that is, in essence, a lie. Professor Eddie Glaude of Princeton University, Morehouse Brother, has a wonderful text out called Begin Again through the lens of himself and particularly James Baldwin, who speaks about, race in his generation, but yet how his voice still has relevance and even more relevance today, even when he wrote his original work.
You mentioned the younger generation being involved in the protests today. Does this younger generation, do you think, approach advocacy for racial justice differently from previous generations?
I think, every generation, in every generation, it was the younger person's marching. In every generation of civil rights, it has been the younger person's on the line. Dr. King was 20s and 30s as he engaged, and many of the lieutenants that were there. So I think the cultural dynamics of the particular generation can adjust particular tactics. Or again, this generation, we have social media in ways that we did not have it in previous generations. So there are always nuances, yet I think the message is basically the same, that this country never intended to include black and brown people in its sense of full citizenship. And that's disconcerting to those who hold the view that America is this bright, shining light. From its beginning, it spoke about its freedom from tyranny of from Britain, while at the same time holding human beings captive. So that is a narrative that is not peripheral or an outlier to the American story, but it is central to the building of this nation, to its wealth. And I think it's hard to face a narrative that you have been told is a lie, or your benefactors or the benefit of what you've been able to take advantage of was done on the backs of human beings against their will.
Why did you feel called to become involved in this movement at this particular time?
I've always been involved in some type of social service, social justice work since I started in ministry here in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and before I was part of an IAF affiliate that looked at structural issues and looked at how they can be addressed on local levels. And then over the course of the decades being here in Connecticut, there have been various issues that we've spoken out against. We attended the counter protest in Charlottesville, Virginia. We have been dealing with issues around race and justice, because they're part of the ministry that I understand. They're not separate, but they're part of what we call the prophetic role of ministry, just as there is a priestly role to visit the sick, to preach, to share visitation, and to administer rites when people make their passages, either in birth or death. But equally as important to those rites and rituals is the call for pastors to be a part of social justice. So for me, this is a part of the ministry that I understand the Bible and the gospel to speak about.
The Reverend Dr. Anthony Bennett is the lead pastor of the Mount Airy Baptist Church in Bridgeport and co-chair of Connect. Pastor Bennett, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Black Lives Matter movement is the most recent manifestation of a long history of resistance and advocacy for civil and racial justice in this country. To better understand what's happening today, we're going to consider what came before. And we've asked Professor Crystal Feimster to take us back to some important periods in our history. Professor Feimster is an associate professor of African American Studies, History, and American Studies at Yale University. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
If we could, I'd like to start with a time that comes to mind for many people, and that's the civil rights movement as it was seen in the 1950s and the 1960s. Could you summarize for us what was going on then?
Well, in the 1950s and 60s, what we witnessed, not me personally, but what Americans living in the 50s and 60s was the rise of a mass movement, an organized mass movement coming out of a range of organizations, from the NAACP organizing legally to contest segregation in the courts. Organizations like SNCC emerging, that's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, emerging in the 1960s to boycott segregation in public accommodations, right, like restaurants and buses and interstate travel. So you see a generation of young Black people coming to age in the 60s after the lynching of Emmett Till on the tale of Brown v. Board of Education ending segregation in public schools, coming of age and really articulating a new kind of Blackness, that it was calling for equality and no longer willing to accommodate segregation or what we think about as the Jim Crow South. And they organized and they took to the streets and they made demands of political leaders at the local, at the state, and the national, at the national level. And again, it was a movement that I think on the face of it, a lot of people thought, oh, where is this movement coming from in the late 1950s and 1960s? But again, it had deep roots in what I would argue a kind of long civil rights movement, roots in the liberal and radical politics of the late 1930s. It accelerated during World War II with the Double V campaigns, and it, you know, stretched far beyond the South. And so I think, again, even if we think about the 50s and 60s, it's easy to pull back that narrative a couple of decades earlier, because those folks who were in the NAACP were building the foundation for what was going to happen in the 50s and 60s. Very much like today, that what's happening now has been in the work aids for a couple of decades. So this movement isn't coming out of nowhere.
Well, touching on the 50s and 60s again, what was the spark then that lit that anti-racism energy, the power towards civil rights in those years? Was it the Emmett Till lynching? Were there more than once? Was there more than one spark involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of young people understood the sort of realities of what it meant to live in the Jim Crow South after the lynching of Emmett Till, and when his mother, Mamie Till, made sure that the images of his body were published in Jet magazine. It really radicalized a new generation of civil rights activists. But I also think it was also about white pushback, right? In that moment after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, the same time that I can say that the civil rights activists of the 50s and 60s were following in the tradition of Black freedom fighters from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you know, white supremacists were holding on to their legacies as well. And, you know, they did not want schools to integrate. And young Black people bore witness to that and responded to that as well. So that there was a dynamic between the kind of what we might think about as the racist white supremacists of the South, even though I wouldn't relegate our understanding of white supremacy to the American South. But in the 50s and 60s, they became the target of Black resistance. And I think that the bus boycott in 55 was a touchstone as well, because that was the moment where you saw mass organizing make a difference, right? That Black people saw that if they came together in an organized fashion to boycott the buses, that they could actually impact the decisions that were being made at the local level, right? And I think that was an important. And we also had a charismatic leader come out of that moment that people were turning to for guidance and direction, and that was Martin Luther King. Mm.
And if we look further back in history, there were acts of resistance long before what I guess we would call the modern-day civil rights movement. Could you touch on some of those key events?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, we can go back to, you know, the arrival of Black folks in this country on slave ships, whether we want to talk about Amistad or we want to talk about the interracial alliances that were created in the 1830s between Black and white abolitionists, right, who organized to end slavery. We can see movements, what most people think about the civil rights movement, they think about it in historical terms as the second Reconstruction. And the first Reconstruction is the 1870s, the moment after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War, where you have Black folks organizing in union leagues and organizing with white Republicans to mobilize political and economic power to ensure Black citizenship and racial equality in the South and the nation as a whole. So I think one of the things that we, when we sort of draw a line back from where we are today, that it's important to keep in mind that there were always these interracial alliances, right, where Black people understood that racial equality required Black white folks to participate in expanding ideas of citizenship, expanding the notion of equal justice under the law, because it's not as if Black people are the only people who suffer from the injustices or the restrictions on who can be a citizen in this country, right?
There have been some observations about the makeup of the crowds in the Black Lives Matter protests in recent weeks being different from earlier demonstrations, namely more white people marching. Is there some truth to that? And does that make this particular time in history different from previous movements?
I think it does. In many ways, I think we see these demonstrations today as extremely diverse, multiracial, not just Black and white people, which is when we think about the interracial public protest and rallies of the 50s and 60s, the kind of image that comes to mind is of Black and white people coming together to make particular sets of demands on changing the Jim Crow South. I think in this moment, you know, we have, you know, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Latinx people are out in the streets because they understand this moment is in some ways different and similar. And when I say different, it's that we have a citizenship that actually understands the connections between racial inequalities and the links to class inequality, the links to transphobia, the links to the way that immigrants are being treated in this country today, right? That these problems and these movements, whether it's environmental issues, they're no longer separate in people's mind, that they actually are able to see connections in ways that they weren't able to see before. And I think that has to do with the groundwork that has been laid, right? You know, if we just go back a decade, or even if we go back to 2016, when the Black Lives Movement articulated their policy platform in which they laid out six demands that called on ending violence and injustice against Black people, redirecting resources from prisons and the military to education, health, and safety, to creating a just, democratically controlled economy, to securing Black political power within a genuine, inclusive democracy. And, you know, they laid out 40, I think, proposals and 34 policy briefs with data and arguments. And those arguments that they made weren't just things that were going to benefit African Americans. They had profound implication, particularly for Latinx communities in this country who are in many ways treated in similar fashions to Black folks. I think also they, in some ways, the arguments that they're making speak to the class realities in this country. And sadly, there are a lot of poor white people in this country that suffer in ways that Black people suffer in this country. And as much as the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s tried to reckon with that issue of class and race and how they intersected and overlapped and tried to link civil rights to workers' rights, if we think about the end of King's life and where he was, right, thinking about workers' rights, I think this moment it's providing an opportunity for people to see where these issues intersect, right? And that Black people don't have to be alone in holding this country to its creed of democracy, liberty, and justice for all. And so I think that's one of the things that's different. I think there's just been a longer education. There have been movements in the last 20 years. Black Lives Movement is part of a larger movement that included the Black Youth Project, 100 Project, the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, Dignity and Power organizations, and even organizations of white people organizing to educate themselves about racism and their own privilege. If we think about groups like Surge showing up for racial justice. So there's just been a longer history in the last 20 years of Black people and white people and brown people talking about and coming up with a language to talk about the inequalities in this country. You know, it's no coincidence that people are able to kind of talk about defunding the police using that language, that they can talk about a carceral state, that they use terms like intersectionality, transphobia. It's because we've been educating ourselves about these issues for over, you know, 3 or 4 decades, and now they've come to a head and people have the tools and some of the historical knowledge to begin to do this work, not just at the local level, not just at the national level, but in the streets, right, in their protests, in their intention to get maybe the White House to pay attention, right, when we see those monuments coming down.
I have one more question. It's kind of a big one.
Okay.
Why is change so hard?
You know, I often say to my students, there are many reasons why change is hard. One is there's just the kind of given that, you know, that I take for granted that power, nobody's going to give up power willingly, right? And the kind of change that we've been calling for in the sort of long history of the Black freedom struggle requires people to give up power. It requires them to share political power, to share economic wealth, and to extend the prosperity to everybody, right? And so I think that's one reason it's hard. I also think it's been difficult for people who, in a society where the middle class has grown pretty quickly, to see how their fates are linked to the poor and the brown people who don't benefit from capitalism in the same way. So I think change is hard, not only because people want to hold on to power, but also because people are afraid to challenge the status quo, that they understand the risk of that, that it means they might actually have to give up something or they may have to put their lives on the line. One of the things that has been inspiring to me is that so many people were willing to put their lives on the line in these last protests because they took to the streets in the middle of a pandemic, right? And were willing to risk getting COVID to make these set of demands to bring an end to police brutality in this country, and that they bore witness to the police state that we have constructed, right, in the way that they were policed as protesters and the brutality that was mobilized against them, right? So that if they had any doubt about how the police have been functioning over the last 100 years, they were disabused of those doubts when they took to the streets and bore witness to the way that the police organized against them in like a military force, right? So I think, yeah, there are a lot of reasons why change is hard. But I think what we're asking for right now is in many ways a revolution, that we're wanting to not just tinker and change a few things. People want to dismantle and reimagine how we police and care for our communities. And in many people's minds, that means you got to start from scratch. You got to tear it down. And that's hard. It's hard to get people to decide that they want to tear down a system that is working for some of them.
Professor Crystal Feimster is an associate professor of African American Studies, History, and American Studies at Yale University. Professor, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about the momentum that's grown around the Black Lives Matter movement following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. This outcry and resistance is not new, but some say this time it does feel different. Is the death of George Floyd the turning point in our culture and how we deal with racism? We invited Professor Crystal Fleming to help us explore this question. She teaches in the Department of Sociology at Stony Brook University on Long Island, and she joins us by phone. Professor Fleming, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Why do you think so many people have been willing to join the recent demonstrations?
Well, you know, I think a lot of observers have pointed out the fact that we are in this really unprecedented moment of the coronavirus and the pandemic crisis and the economic crises that are bound up with all of that. So you, just on a very practical level, you have many people who, you know, would have been working in person, who had the opportunity to march and join protests. You have people who spending more time at home, reading the news, maybe having to confront some of the, you know, violent realities of racism, but also people who are feeling vulnerable, maybe more acutely, as a result of all of the anxieties and fears, many of them well-founded, that people are grappling with in this moment. So I think, you know, it's the convergence of, you know, many crises, but also the extraordinary circumstance of the ways that people are actually living their day-to-day lives, many of them at home, spending more time reading, learning more about the various political movements that have been happening for a long time.
Observations have been made, too, about the makeup, the demographics of the people who are marching in the streets, looking somewhat different than protests have looked in the past.
Tom, are you trying to say there are more white people in the
pretty much,
the
pretty
movement?
Much.
Yeah, I mean, so yes, I have. You know, that's an observation I share. I think that there are certainly images of the protests more white Americans than we're used to seeing. But you know, there's always been a minority of white people who have been mobilized in anti-racist movements. I think we are seeing more, and that, I think, is a very positive thing. But it's important to understand that there is also a historical tradition of white anti-racism, of white protests against white supremacy, and white support for various abolitionist movements. But, you know, it's been, I think it's been growing, and we're seeing more white Americans begin to wake up to the harsh realities of racial oppression that Black people and Indigenous people and people of color have been living with for generations.
I'm wondering, how do you think the video of George Floyd, where we really saw the life being choked out of him right there in front of our eyes, how did that contribute, do you think, to the intensity of the momentum that followed, the protests that followed? After all, there have been graphic videos before. The police chokehold that killed Eric Garner in Staten Island, the police shooting of Laquan McDonald in Chicago several years ago. Is it different this time for some reason, or is this a cumulative effect?
I think you're getting at something, Tom, with the idea of a cumulative effect. I think there's also the reality that no matter how harsh or violent or, horrific an image is of a Black person being killed or lynched or murdered, if you don't have the consciousness and the awareness that you're actually seeing a human being whose life matters and whose life has value be unjustly killed, then that image is not going to spur you into action. There has to be a change in your own awareness that will make an image or a video like that push you into action. And so I think that there has been over the course of many years, but, you know, including the last, you know, the developments of the last 5 to 10 years, where, you know, largely as a result of the contemporary movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter, Ferguson uprisings. But before that, you know, a number of other kinds of public mobilizations around inequality, the Occupy movement, which preceded the contemporary Black Lives Matter movement. There's been an awareness building about the, you know, the persistence of inequalities and gross forms of oppression. That I think, you know, is starting to build a larger critical mass of people who are ready to say, you know, we have to take proactive steps and measures. We have to be actively involved in building a better society. And importantly, that we have the power to do that, right? So I think that's another huge element of activism and social movements, right? We know that if you don't believe that change is possible, and if you feel that you don't have power, then that's going to reinforce the status quo. And I think we're seeing more and more people wake up to the fact that we have the power to change our society. We have the civic responsibility to be a part of that change.
A couple of years ago, you published a book entitled How to Be Less Stupid About Race. And you say that, that most people in this country are really not well educated about racism, about white supremacy, and how that really permeates the culture, and how it it creates systems that do maintain the status quo. And with this knowledge, perhaps we can begin to right the ship. Are you saying that we perhaps are on the cusp of moving in that direction? Are we moving into a different era?
Well, I sure hope so. I sure hope so, because, you know, we have been, you know, dealing with centuries of racism and racial violence and really immorality. And I mention morality because, you know, there's, you can have all the books in the world. You can have all of the research and empirical studies that show you about the harm of racism and the impact on Black communities and on indigenous people and communities of color. But knowledge is not enough. The sociologist W.B. Du Bois, you know, who I write about in my work and in my book, it's been very influential for me. And he started his career. You know, he was the first African-American to get a Ph.D. at Harvard. And he started his career really believing that, you know, if you did enough scientific studies, that would be enough to end racism. And what he learned is that there's no amount of knowledge that's enough. What one needs is activism and moral courage and a willingness, right, to use this knowledge to improve society. So I think what's also changing, and it also needs to continue to change. We're far off from an anti-racist society. We're not there yet. But what I think we're beginning to see is a willingness and more moral courage among people to really face the harsh realities of racism and, again, you know, decide to actively be a part of creating anti-racist change. But this is not just about knowledge. Knowledge is important. And, you know, I'm still a sociologist. I'm still a scholar and an educator. But it's also very clear, I think, to people who work on these issues that you have to actually have a willingness to turn this knowledge into transformative change.
When the term white supremacy is used, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, at least that I've spoken with, they think of it in the extreme, sort of like, you know, uppercase W, uppercase, you know, S.
Exactly.
Like neo-Nazis, as opposed to maybe lowercase, which is calling attention to the systemic, systemic problem that exists, and that's not seen.
I mean, and that's exactly why I wrote my book, you know, exactly that, you know, trying to get people to understand white supremacy, not just as the KKK or extremist movements, but as the system of power that we're still living with that this isn't a new idea, actually. You know, Martin Luther King, people don't talk about this version of King because we get this sanitized image of King and his message. But Martin Luther King talked about white supremacy as a system of power. He talked about white supremacy as being embedded, you know, in the culture of our society. And we've lost that in the national discourse until relatively recently. And I think that, you know, going back to some of the basics, you know, that have been rooted in the Black political tradition and Black activism and anti-racist activism, we can have this systemic understanding so that we're not focused just on extremism, but really focused on, you know, how are resources allocated in our society and how can we promote, you know, a more just and inclusive and really a transformed society.
Professor Fleming, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think about when you ponder race? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. And on Twitter, we're at FullStoryWSHU. That's it for the Full Story today. Produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thanks for listening to the Full Story.